Hey there, I'm Siobhan Reed, your guide here on Future Health Now, where we're all about advocating for health equity and generational wellness starting today. If you're a public health professional, a parent, or a community leader concerned about the well-being of our next generation, then you are in the right place. A great way to plug into this community is to sign up for our monthly newsletter at futurehealthnow.com, where we'll keep you informed about upcoming events, educational content, and ways to stay engaged. Today, we're hearing from Jeff Johnston, who will share his secrets and inspiration behind the Living Undeterred Project and how he's on a mission to save Gen Z. Let's jump right in. Hi, Jeff. How are you today?
I am living the dream. I cannot believe how beautiful it is here in Iowa.
I want to reflect a little bit on your early career. What lessons from door-to-door sales experience shaped your resilience and determination later in life?
Well, fortunately for me, at 23, when I graduated college with a finance degree, I was very naive to the point where someone said, "Do you want to make $75,000 a year?" And I said, "Yeah, where do I sign?" You know, like I was some athlete or rock star. And I didn't know I was just going to be selling life insurance door to door. But fortunately, in hindsight now, that fact that I was just super naive and no fear, that I went door to door and sold life insurance and got slammed on, yelled at, spit at. I'd sell a policy, celebrate, and then the next week, my friend would cancel it. I'd have to pay back the commission that I got advanced. So then I had to sell two policies to make up for the one that got canceled. And I just learned at a young age that I was going to have to go out and make my future. I wasn't going to have anything handed to me. I grew up in a very privileged family. My grandma gave me half her Social Security check to stay in school. So she gave half it to my other brother and half to me. And she said, "You can have that as long as you stay in school." So I was really motivated to finish college. And I didn't know I was going to be doing life insurance. And after about a year, I decided to get my securities licenses. So I got my 6 and 63, and so I could start selling mutual funds and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it took off. My best friend my whole life, Brock Renner, we decided over, I think it was wings and beer and playing pool one night, that we just form a company. And, you know, then all of a sudden, boom, you know, I wake up and I'm 50 and I've got, you know, 9 full-time employees, 7 staff, happily married to my wife, Prudence, 3 boys, mm-hmm. you know, traveling, accumulating stuff, big house, cars, you know, thinking I had it all figured out, you know. But then again, one of the illusions with life is that you really never figure anything out. You just keep evolving.
Right.
But I didn't realize that until that fateful day where everything changed for me and why I'm here today. And, but no, I think resiliency, I learned from, an unwavering confidence that I can get through this. I can get through it. And I've never been on a salary since age 23. I've always been on a commission or some type of a income where I got paid for what I was worth. Mm-hmm. And I've taught my two boys that right now, you know, about, do you want to work for somebody or do you want to work for yourself? And the sooner you can figure that out, I think the more enjoyable the life will be for you over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I've been pushing my girls, you know, to prioritize education, but also prioritize what it is that they're passionate about so that they can own their time, because life is short. And so if you have more freedom and flexibility, there's just so much to that. So I'm right there with you on that. But now tell me, in the face of personal and familial challenges, what inspired your shift from a successful investment career to founding a startup focused on teen mental health?
It's a great question. I think the ability to pivot, I think the ability to reframe. Mm-hmm. So most people run through life and things happen to them. Mm-hmm. And if you can tell yourself that things happen for you, that goes from a victim mindset to what I say is a victor mindset. Mm. And so, you know, I can get up today. Something will happen today, may not go the way I want. It may be painful, may be traumatic. And it's either something that I can take as a victim, why me, why now, pity, sympathy, woe is me, why not somebody else? And that's the mindset most people probably live in day to day. That's why we have this tremendous, massive number of unhappy humans on this planet, and specifically in Gen Z, which is where my heart is right now, the youth of the world. You know, I just, And then, or you can say to yourself, even though it may sound not correct at the time, that this happened for me in some way, find belief in that. Mm-hmm. You know, what you believe is what you will become, you know, and so you can believe a diagnosis is what you are, who you are, mm-hmm. like attention deficit or bipolar or depression, or you could not participate with that narrative. And even if someone diagnoses you with those things, you're not obligated to believe them. And I really do that we're not even using, and I think science can prove this, that we're using a very small percentage of our brains and our minds and our power that we have over things. And we just kind of go through life playing defense, you know, putting out fires. And that's the mindset today. And it's like, so for me, you know, it's been a combination of many things, but I'm very grateful that what happened in my life, as painful, I mean, I just had an episode this morning where I intensely cried about 10 minutes after I got this morning. Like for most people, it would be a once in a year type cry, but I have these every day. Mm-hmm. But when I was done, I felt so liberated. I almost laughed. Like, thank you, grief, for kicking me in the face at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I got on my elliptical and I had a great workout. So again, I'm just a guy from Iowa. I'm not any philosophical genius. I've just figured out ways to kind of trick my lizard brain to not participate in these narratives that are presented by everybody else. Like depression's a thing or anxiety's a thing. It's like, okay, sure it is possibly, but what happens if it's not? What happens if it's just part of who we are as humans? So I'm having a tough day. I'm just sad. What is wrong with that? Why do we have to disorder everything? So my passion, my mission is to stop pathologizing everything that seems to me clearly is just normal human emotions for all of us, and accept them for what they are and who we are, mm-hmm. use them for our strengths, and not just improve our lives, but the people around us. I mean, isn't that really what reciprocity is all about? You know, when someone does something good for you, you pay it back. We don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. We just cut people off. We flip them off. We yell at people when they, you know, interfere with what we're trying to do. It's like we've kind of lost this ability to really understand each other. And I think there's a renaissance coming. I think you're seeing a revolt from a lot of people that are kind of, you know, giving up on participating in that. I'm one of them.
Yeah, I'm one of those too. I always have this mantra of guard your heart, right? Because what you allow to get into your mind and your spirit and soul is like, that is what will be reflected outwardly. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, because definitely want to make sure that we are pouring into Gen Z and that they're not feeling like they are a part of this rat race and they just have to, you know, go and buy into these concepts of they are these, you know, things that are not positive.
Yeah. And I heard a quote someone said the other day, where your attention goes, your energy flows.
Yes.
And I think I was working out and I stopped and I ran over here, and like I always do, you know, on an hour elliptical run, I'll have 20 notes on my desk that I'll jump off and write. You know, it's just like these things pop in my head. And I heard that quote and I thought, what a great quote for kids, is where your attention goes, your energy flows. So you wonder why our energy is zapped or our energy is negative. Well, watch what they watch on TikTok. Mm-hmm. Watch what they watch on Instagram. You know, we're not, I say we as in adults, I don't speak on behalf of all adults, but I think there's a lot of us out there that aren't saying abstinence is the only way. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying take your cell phone and throw it in the lake. That's unrealistic. That's like saying don't do drugs, don't have sex, don't, you know, don't do these things. That's not going to happen.
Right.
But where they spend their time on their phones, i.e. their attention, is where their energy will flow. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more of, instead of cutting down kids and saying, well, less screen time, let's see how many hours you're on your phone. Let's say, well, you can be on your phone 5 hours. Let's see where you're at. Let's see where your attention is. And I think that's an easier way to talk to this generation than just yelling at them and telling them that we're punishing them by taking their phone away. I mean, that's what you do with little kids with their toys. You know, these aren't little kids. Let's give them some respect. And we could say, maybe you're on your phone a little longer than you need to be. But more importantly, where is your attention going when you're on the phone?
Right.
You can follow. I can be on Twitter 3 hours a day, Siobhan. Mm-hmm. I could be following unbelievably great humans, or I could be on it 3 hours a day and following idiots.
Yes.
That's so it's true. Not the 3 hours. It's that that's the problem with, you know, looking at statistics. It isn't the 3 hours that someone's on their phone. It's what are they doing with those 3 hours? Mm-hmm. That's everything. So I don't tell my boys, don't do X. All I have to say to them, when you look in the mirror and you see that one person staring back, you can't lie to anyone else in your life. You certainly can't lie. You can lie to everyone else in your life, sorry, but you can't lie to the person in the mirror. That person is truth. So everything else around you, I can't do anything about that, but you can't trick that person looking at you. So you have to make sure during your day, you can look in the mirror and feel real good about yourself.
Right.
I'm not sure most people can. I mean, they can, they just don't.
Right. Yeah. It's not like a
practice. We all can. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Cause we don't have that motivation and encouragement sometimes because we are caught up in the, you know, the minutia of how things are and just allowing society to just kind of give us a lead on how we should go. And so we just kind of ebb and flow, but interesting. So you mentioned grief. Mm-hmm. And choosing a positive, you know, definition rather than letting it define you negatively. Mm-hmm. Where did the whole term of bitter versus better go? And how do you inspire your sons to deal with their grief?
It's a great question. And I can actually reverse engineer it back to a moment in time mm-hmm. when this better, not bitter mindset thing popped into my head. It was the day our son died from fentanyl poisoning. I was 50, October 4th, 2016, Seth was 23. So that's another hour podcast we can talk about. But I think your question, to answer your question, where did this come from? My two boys had to come home. They were 15 and 13. Mm-hmm. My wife, you can imagine having to tell my wife that our son died at 23, our oldest son, Seth. I sat in the living room. My wife's to my right. Two boys are on the couch. Ian just got home from a golf tournament and Roman was 13, just got off the bus. Very impressionable age. As a matter of fact, sibling bereavement is the number one most impactful event in the life of an adolescent, more than losing a parent, is losing a brother or sister. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that till I wrote my book. But anyway, I'm sitting there in the living room. I look at my two boys and this is the moment where it popped in. I'm an ex-athlete. I played two sports in college, basketball and golf. I've always been, I would say, high strung, always competitive. Well, death came into my life. I wasn't going to let it beat me. You know, I had to take this and somehow reframe it, present it, repackage it to my two boys as an opportunity. Now, at the moment, I didn't think it was an opportunity. I was playing all the things in my head. So, but I had to trick my boys to think that I was superhuman. You know, I was a wreck. The worst moment in my entire lifetime up to that point. And I sat up from the couch. I looked at the boys and I cleared my voice. And I said, boys, we have one of two roads to go down. And this two roads is where the better, not bitter came from. And it came a chapter in my book. And metaphorically it was that door opened in my life. I never really thought about life this way. I said, boys, we have one of two roads to go down. We have one road of anger, despair, and hatred, and we'll become alcoholics and addicts ourselves. Or we have a road of inspiration and motivation, and this can be the single greatest moment in our lives and those around us to make a difference. I'm on the second road. I ask you to join me. And I'm like, Siobhan, I'm like, I don't know where the heck that came from. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. I didn't rehearse it. I don't like to rehearse things. I'd rather talk for an hour with no script than talk for 10 minutes with a script. That was a dad moment for me. And that was a husband moment for me. You get just three or four in your entire lifetime where an opportunity is going to come up where you can set the tone for the rest of the life of your family and your people around you. And that was what death did on that morning of October 4th, 2016, was giving me an opportunity to be a better man, not a bitter man. Mm-hmm. However, it didn't work out that way. For 14 months after that great speech I gave to my kids, I stayed home and drank alcohol every single day with my wife. called every negative human I knew in my brain, invited them over to the biggest pity party you could ever have, did it every day, got up to 190 pounds. I've been an alcoholic for 34 years prior to this, Siobhan, which I didn't mention, but it was 5 days a week and I was functional. This was 7 days a week, all day long. And then finally, Siobhan, on December 24, 2017, I just looked in the mirror as 14 months after Seth died. And I said, enough's enough. And I stopped. So back to your question, the whole living undeterred, better, not bitter, two roads, all that came from that moment when something was put into me to articulate to my two boys and my wife that we have no other choice. You know, the other choice is misery and despair. Who wants to be on that road? Mm-hmm. I certainly don't. But the road of better isn't easy. It's hard. It's harder to be better than it is to be bitter. It's easy to be bitter. It's much harder to be opportunistic and positive. Okay? It is. It's harder because it takes work and focus and concentration and commitment and faith. Being bitter is easy. Drinking's easy. Doing drugs, I mean, I'm not criticizing those that are in the struggle because I was. But that was the easy road. You know, it was not a fun road, but certainly easier to get up every day and drink. And so that's where that came from, you know, and for me, it wasn't immediate, but for my two boys, it was. They both are amazing that what they've done, despite what happened in their life. And I told them one time, and this was before what happened next, but I told them one time, I sat them down when they were right after Seth died. And I said, you know, guys, this is your competitive advantage over your peer group. Mm. This is why when you get an F or you get that no for a job or you ask that person out and they say no, you're not going to be devastated. You know what devastating is? Most people don't. Mm-hmm. And then that was topped off with my wife dying from alcoholism the day after my youngest son turned 18. So again, I presented this. Now you guys have a real competitive advantage. You know, you're 18 and 20 and you've lost your older brother and your mom. But you got to find something beautiful in all this. And, you know, I was counseling a mom that lost their son. He was 7 to cancer. And we were just talking about things. And as I was talking to her, I realized my son died at 23. He could have died at 7. I'm grateful for those extra years I had with Seth. So anyone that loses somebody, just think there's always somebody that lost someone too, but most times it's younger. And I had great times with Seth and my wife. My wife was 46. She could have died at 35.
Right.
You know, so it's like, it's perspective. And that really gets me through my day when I am taking my youngest daughter, Brighton, or my granddaughter, sorry. So when Seth died, his daughter was born. Her name is Brighton, which is the name of my startup company. But I was taking her to school the other day and I pulled up, letting her out the door, and I see this van pull up and they open up the back and they bring a wheelchair out. There's this, you know, 5-year-old girl that has to get carried out of the van and put in the wheelchair because she can't walk. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, my granddaughter can walk. You know, she doesn't have a dad. Seth died and her mom's gone. We don't know where her mom is. She's struggling with substance abuse, but she can walk. I'm grateful for that. Wow. So it's perspective. It's, we all have this ability to do this, but we don't know how to unlock that. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's, you know, I work really hard to get me in this place, but I struggle every day. Every single day is hard for me. Sometimes it's right when I wake up. Sometimes it's right when I get off a podcast. Sometimes it's when I go to bed. But I don't fight it anymore. I just accept it as part of the deal that I made to be alive.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for sharing that and being vulnerable with us here.
Some people won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is often laced into illicit drugs and used to make fake versions of prescription pills. You can't see it, taste it, or or smell it. Suppliers mix fentanyl into their products because it's potent and cheap. And the dealer might not even know. Keep yourself and others safe by knowing the real deal on fentanyl. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into those struggles because we talked about, you know, adverse childhood experiences and how you said, well, I grew up with basically a silver spoon in my mouth and I grew up just the opposite. Yet you struggle with alcoholism and I don't drink. I would not touch a drink. I don't even go near it. And I even get teased at times, you know, because all my peers are drinking and they'll go, you know, my drink of choice would be a Shirley Temple with extra grenadine. Right.
Yeah.
We talk also about prevention and how that's kind of negative and, and you're trying to change that phenomenon. What are like, what it, I mean, from your perspective, there are two reasons why children actually would end up trying or, you know, indulging or experimenting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So for me, I grew up, like you said, and I call it the Leave It to Beaver. If you've ever seen the show, Leave It to Beaver, pretty simple middle-class family. Dad's a doctor, mom stayed home, raised four boys, you know, not a lot of adversity and trauma. But my experience with alcohol started at about 16. And it wasn't because I was escaping something traumatic, because that's reason one people go down that road of substance abuse and addiction is they're trying to mask some underlying cause. So the symptom is sadness. I mean, you're sad from something. And, you know, there's lots of things. Like it could have been you were sexually abused. You're physically abused. You were emotionally abused. You were poor. You know, there's lots of reasons that could have caused trauma in your life. But then the symptoms start to come out. You're sad. You're angry. You're frustrated. You're depressed. You know, those are all symptoms of something bigger. And so for me, I didn't have any of that. So the second reason why people go down these roads, especially kids, is exploration. So you have escaping and you have exploration. I was curious. I am hyper. I'm intense. I'm bored easily. I was small town Iowa. You know, we just got alcohol and we drove around the back roads and we talked about things that boys talk about, you know, and we drank and then we went home and fell asleep. And then just did that again and did it again. And nobody ever died. No one got arrested. Nobody, we didn't break into homes. We didn't steal cars. We just, we were mostly bored. And I think that's a part that doesn't go talked about very often. We say, oh, these kids are drinking because they're dealing with trauma. Not, I don't think that is true. I think probably the majority are. But there's a large group of young men and women that get into these things because they're bored. Now, I played every sport at small town Iowa. I played, I track baseball, football, basketball. So I wasn't bored from like my time. I wasn't sitting around, had free time all the time. I just was bored about that routine I was in. It wasn't stimulating me enough. And then as I got into college, gambling replaced that. Well, I shouldn't say replace it. I drank more in college than I ever did in my lifetime, but I added gambling. But like you, you know, you said the alcohol, you kept away from that. I couldn't until I was 52 when I quit, but my vice was gambling. But I never did drugs. I never did a drug, never smoked pot, never did anything remotely close to that until my first psychedelic experience, which was February of this year. So I was 57. It was the first time I ever put a substance like that in my body. And that's a whole different topic. We can talk someday down the road, how life-changing that was for me. But I never did the drug thing. Because Siobhan, I knew my relationship with gambling was when I walked into a casino, I wanted to win all the money the casino had. If I brought $5,000, I didn't want to just walk out with seven or 10. I wanted to walk out with 50 million. Well, obviously that didn't go very well. Instead of not just walking out with my money, I would lose it all. Then I'd go to the ATM or write a check and I would lose double what I walked in with. I knew, I was smart enough to know that my relationship with gambling would be the same relationship with drugs. I'd want to do all the drugs. I knew that. And so I had at that time as an addict with alcohol and gambling, I knew enough that I could never do drugs because I knew I would like them and I knew I couldn't be able to stop. So for the grace of God or whatever, I was fortunate never to dabble in drugs, and I wouldn't be here today if I did. I'm fairly certain of that.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, because then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Me too. Me too.
So tell me a little bit about how do you envision changing the narrative around mental health, particularly in these young generations, right? Especially through the app.
I don't think it's that complicated. I'm horribly optimistic that the largest generation in human history, a third of the world's population, Gen Z, which is 14 to 26, despite all the struggles they have and all the cutting down that everyone does in that generation, I think they're the most encouraging generation in human history, if not for one reason. They're the first generation in human history for their number one New Year's resolution to be optimizing mental wellness. We've never had that before in human history. So we have this third of the world's population. Their number one New Year's resolution this year was optimizing mental wellness. So I know there's a demand. I know that one in five kids today are in serious crisis mode. And I mean serious crisis mode. I don't mean just having a bad day. I'm talking about considering suicide, cutting themselves, vaping every day, drinking, dropping out of school. I mean, serious crisis mode. One in five, that's 20%.
Right.
That's 20% of 20% of a third of the world. That's a lot of negative collateral damage in family. See, you don't have to have somebody die in a family to cause devastation and destruction.
Right.
Myth number one. If my son and my wife don't die, I still have devastation and destruction in my family. Just a different type. So people that are watching this that haven't had death, they're like, well, I can't compete with Jeff. I haven't been through, you know, that's a myth. It's not true. You know, you don't have to compete with me to be miserable. Or to even be better. I have nothing to do with your life. You're competing with yourself. And so I'm very aware that my story is kind of really out there with two deaths. And then, you know, my mom passed away 4 months after my wife did. And how many people still have great relationships with their mom and dad? You know, my dad's still here, but everyone else is gone.
I also wanted to kind of get touch on the guilt because sometimes we have this, I don't know, perception that things are going well. Like you try so hard as a parent to just provide the platform for your kids to do great things and to be better than you were. And you give them all these advantages. And sometimes we'll see like different thought leaders say, oh, well, you can't teach grit in that way. And so I just wonder, because I know you probably never in a million years imagined that Seth would be, you know, struggling the way he did. And I think parents in general just don't, they kind of have like this denial, because I've had my own struggles as a parent. And I just wonder, like, what is that shame and guilt? Like, how do you get over it and get through it?
Good question. I don't think you do. I don't know if you want it. I don't know if you want to. It drives me right now. It motivates me. Maybe I am atypical. Maybe maybe most people, it drags them down like a weight on their ankles in the water. For me, it pulls me out. Grief is a friend of mine. Grief is my ally. Sadness, tears. Those are things that, you know, I've never, ever in my entire lifetime, the saddest moment I've ever had, the worst cry I've ever had, 100% of the time I've made it through. 100%. I've survived. What makes me think I can't the next? That's my mindset. So I'm not asking for death to come in my life again. Matter of fact, I'd appreciate it if death just left me the hell alone for a while. But if it did today, I wouldn't fight it. I certainly wouldn't say, oh, why me? Everybody around me is dying. You know, I'm a victim. Why is it this person has his wife and his kids and everything is going? Then you start playing that narrative of comparison and imposter syndrome and all that stuff starts. And then your own life starts crumbling. It's like, that family has nothing to do with me. That their happiness has nothing to do with my happiness. But their misery has nothing to do with my misery. You know, these are all things I can control. And Viktor Frankl talked about that in Man's Search for Meaning, which is probably the best, most impactful book I ever read, where he just said, you know, what got him through was his attitude when he was in the concentration camps, and his empathy he had even for his prison guards. He actually cared about them and their families. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that may have spared him when they were just randomly killing people, you know. There's lessons to be learned in all this stuff. And I think when people hear my story or they hear yours, I'm about to read your book. And by the way, your daughter, I mean, man, what a rock star. I can't wait to read her book. But there's stories in all these things. That's the beauty of vulnerability. That's the beauty of your podcast. The beauty of us being able to have these conversations is if someone could hear my story and say, man, my 12-year-old could be Seth someday. He could be Ian someday. He could be Jeff. You know, what can I do? What can I take from Jeff's conversation with Siobhan and unpack and go to my current situation and try to help or empower somebody who's struggling? And that's really what this whole journey is all about that I'm on, is taking from you what I can to use in my life and then giving back more. Like, I want to produce more than I consume every day.
Right.
I want to be a net positive to the world. So if I'm taking things from you, I have to replace that and add some. And that's altruism, that's giving back. I don't think most people think that way. I think during the day, most people take and take and consume and take and me, and it's about me and it's about we. Mm-hmm. That's how we right this ship of humanity that's just sinking. You know, we can blame it on the cell phones. We can blame it on politics, blame it on Trump, or blame it on whatever you want to blame it on.
Right.
But none of that has any impact on what I'm going to do in the next 15 minutes of my life.
Right.
You know, what I do, what I read, what I watch, what I drink and eat, I can control all that.
Right.
Probably why I don't watch TV. I don't watch any TV. I just watch documentaries, basically, you know. But I wasn't always that way, Siobhan. That's the thing. People maybe see me now and think, God, you've always been. No, I was, until my son died, I was a spiteful person. I was not a happy person. I'm not saying his death made me happy, but I think you know what I mean in that context. Mm-hmm. Until something was taken from me, painfully, under my watch, as the proverbial man of the house,
right?
7-year train wreck. I watched my dad be a provider for his 4 sons. I couldn't do that for Seth. I couldn't do it for my wife. It has to stop. I mean, somebody's got to draw a line in the sand, and I'm one of millions of people. You're one as well that are trying to draw that line in the sand and get these kids to start looking at what they have in front of them is beautiful. It's great. They should be in awe and reverence of life. And, you know, just we have more abundance than we've ever had, especially in the United States. I mean, how just naive and how, I don't know. I really don't know how people can complain about what we have, to be honest with you.
Right.
We're pretty lucky. And all you got to do is just travel overseas, some places of the world, and you don't have to even say anything to that person. They'll come back and kiss the ground when they get here.
Absolutely. You know? That happened to me, seriously.
Me too.
And for 8 days, and I mean, I came back changed for sure. And I think one of the things that I really had to do in order to get over all the trauma and hurt and pain of my adverse childhood experiences was to really lean into hope and optimism. And so I really live in the moment and the memories of yesterday. And I shared this story, I think, plenty of times, but I take pictures, especially on the days when I'm struggling, so that I can look back and reflect and say, you know what? It really wasn't that bad. And I think the more that you can reflect on all the positive as well as the negative, you know, it gives you this different type of gratitude that really is uplifting and gives you so much hope for all that's to come in the future. So I would encourage any and everyone to just know that it could always be worse, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just that whole idea of impermanence, which is a term that the Stoics used thousands of years ago, just that, you know, if you're sitting there and you have a thought pop into your head. So this is something that in meditation happens. I meditated about 32 minutes this morning and I had probably 1,000 thoughts come in my head. Mm-hmm. But if you ask yourself, okay, where did this thought come from? So where was it before I had it? Well, it didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It literally came from neurons firing in our brain, pulling back memories, tying things together. It didn't exist a second before it was in my mind. It was in my mind. And then if you realize thoughts, the same thing happens on the other end when they go out the door. They just go away. So if you can have these thoughts and you can train yourself to just not attach to them, just don't even accept them as yours. When you have negative thoughts, you're more the witness or the observer of the thought versus someone who's actually jumping on and attaching themselves. And those thoughts can pop in quickly and start dragging you down. And that's where people that bipolar go up and down so much. They're just latching onto those thoughts continuously all day long. So I'm not saying bipolar doesn't exist. I'm saying that we have more control over the choices that we make. And you, believe it or not, choose to identify with your thoughts. I really believe that. Now, it's not like if I had cancer, I don't choose to identify with cancer. That's a physical thing in my body that I not much I can do other than do what I can. But if something pops into my head and says, Jeff, you know, you're going to fail today. Or whatever negative thought comes in, like your podcast you're doing is a failure. Your book's not going to sell copies. And all of a sudden I attached to that. A thought wasn't there just a second ago. And now it shows up. And I identify with it. Now I'm latched onto it. Now wherever it goes, and most times they're negative, it starts pulling me down. Or somehow, if you can just look at that thought, here it comes. Here comes grief. Here comes negativity. Here comes anger. I'm not going to jump on this thing. I'm going to let it just go right by. Go someone else's head. Mm-hmm. It's a game. It's a game that I play.
Yeah.
And sometimes I jump on those thoughts and it drags me down and I cry and I punch the wall and I feel like a failure. I'm okay with it. I'm absolutely okay with identifying occasionally, but I'm getting better. I've only been meditating about 3 years, but it saved my life. It has. It really has opened my mind literally up to understanding where these things come from. And I'm under no obligation to identify with an emotion or a thought. Because the prior state is they don't exist. Mm-hmm. So after the thought does what it does, it dies a slow death. That's the word impermanence. Everything has an ending. So when you're at a graduation and you got your daughter up there and she's getting some award and you're all happy, you have to realize that this moment is going to be gone.
Right.
So instead of it fake taking your phone and trying to do selfies and all this crap, it's like, no, just love the moment.
Right.
Okay. Well, the worst moment in your life when I'm on my floor crying and I'm thinking about my son and my wife, and I'm just like, I don't want to live. I have to think to myself, well, that's going to die too. That thought's going to die just like the happy thoughts do. And if you can learn to just kind of have that balance, maybe it's the old yin and yang that they talked about, mm-hmm. and just kind of live in the middle of that.
Right.
That's all I'm trying to teach kids. That's all I'm trying to work with kids is to understand their emotions are not, we shouldn't pathologize things like anxiety and sadness and create these terms, identify with them and give them antidepressants. And then you're putting out fires the rest of their life.
Right.
We don't have to do that. We as parents, you as a parent, we can draw a line in the sand. The doctor wanted to give my son Prozac the other day. I said, over my dead body. Mm-hmm. And my son hugged me in the car. He's 20. He said, thank you, son. Thank you, dad.
Right.
Now, is that the right thing to do? I don't know. It's the right thing to do for my son at that moment in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't speak for somebody else. And that's my why, Siobhan. That's why I do what I do. I think I'm just compelled to try to help kids. That's where I'm at now at 57 years old. And it's rewarding, but it's very hard work.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that you mentioned about the different emotions. That's why I really love that movie Inside Out, because it actually gives you an opportunity to see the different emotions. And then I have my joy pen that I, you know, always keep near, because it's like, that's who I choose to identify with, you know?
Yeah.
Now, I'll say that sharing your story and your experiences through the podcast and writing the book, definitely very, very commendable. So I thank you so much for that. I just want to know, like right now, what is giving you the most hope?
That sounds odd. I just don't like that word. Hope is almost, to me, just a word. I'm waiting for something to happen. It's like, I think I just need to be in action. I need to be moving for me. I can't wait for something to happen in my life. It's like, I look back just a year ago and how different a human being I am. And in a year from now, I'm going to look back and I'm going to say, God, when I was on Siobhan's podcast, man, I'm such a different. So the hope for me is that I'm evolving. Mm-hmm. I'm adapting. And I don't ever want to stay the same. Physically, I look different. I think I look better than I did before I quit drinking. I was 190 pounds. I was disheveled. Mm-hmm. I think I look better. I feel better. I'm around more optimistic people. So for me, hope is okay. Faith is okay. But I don't have time to wait for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's like right now, what can I do? What are five things I can do today to better myself and the people in my life around me? And that ripple effect, if I can get people around me to pull them up a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, motivate them, inspire them, and they go on to their friends that's down and they go to their friends that are down. Imagine you and I doing that today and then take that times 7 billion people.
Right.
We don't need to take all these freaking antidepressants and all these drugs and see all these therapists and stuff. We can do all this internally. We have the ability. We have it right inside of us and in front of us. We're just not utilizing it yet. Mm-hmm. And when kids right now, they don't know about these things. We have the benefit of wisdom and hindsight, and they don't. And that's our competitive advantage.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Now tell me, how can our listeners follow your thought leadership? How can they get involved to support your mission and the Brighten app?
Yeah, I have a lot of things out there. So all someone has to do is go to Facebook, type in, you know, Jeff Johnston, type in Brighten, B-R-I-G-H-T-N, mm-hmm. Type in Living Undeterred Project, type in Living Undeterred. I think I have 4 Facebook accounts. Okay. I'm on Instagram as well, TikTok, LinkedIn. I think if you go to the App Store, you just mm-hmm. under, like if you have an Apple, I have an Apple phone, mm-hmm. iPhone. I think it's under Brighten Wellness in the App Store. So it's B-R-I-G-H-T-N Wellness. And then you can download the app. It's free right now. We are going to be putting in a subscription model sometime early next year for kids that want to unlock and go deeper into their experience with the Brighten curriculum. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that's, I'm pretty much all over the social media outlets, but I'm open to talk to anybody. I'm trying to get on as many podcasts as I can this next year. That's one of the reasons why I'm not doing my podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to do this more. I think I have more ability to reach more people if I go on other podcasts versus doing my own. So I've kind of sacrificed my own love of podcasting mm-hmm. to get the word out for our Brighten initiative for the time being. So just when you reached out to me, I'm like, wow, this is great. It's beautiful. You and I bonded very quickly. I love what you're doing. You've mm-hmm. already introduced me to, I'm meeting someone today because of you.
Awesome.
Yeah. Josh, I won't say his last name, but I'm meeting him actually in about an hour. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't wait to talk to him.
Last name.
Josh Perry.
Really great friends. And he actually recorded his episode yesterday. So
yeah, that's what he told me.
Sharing both. Yes. This is so incredibly great. And I really, really appreciate you taking the time to share your voice here and be present. And I just want to say thank you. And I've already downloaded the app and I'm loving it. And I want to know all about the upcoming events and everything. And I'll definitely put all of the links to everything you've shared into our show notes for our listeners.
Well, I have a saying I'll leave this with, and I think applies to everything. Purpose uh-huh. becomes passion when it gets personal. Purpose mm-hmm. becomes passion when it gets personal. So for those people out there struggling, find something very personal make it your passion, and it will be your purpose.
That's a wrap to another edition of Future Health Now. We're incredibly grateful for the opportunity to serve you with this content and want to stay connected. The best way to do this is to sign up for our monthly newsletter at futurehealthnow.com. While you're there, we want to hear your feedback and make sure you feel this community is a resource that helps you feel best equipped for the public health education journey, one that you'll be proud to be a part of, and share the content with others so we can empower the healthiest, well-informed human population in history. If you haven't already rated the show on Apple or wherever you listen to your podcast, please simply tap the number of stars you feel this show deserves. This helps to get this content in front of more people and again, gauge how we can continually add more value to this community. This podcast wouldn't be possible without the help from our executive producer and production team at Chat with Leaders Media. If you're looking to launch your very own B2B growth podcast in the industry you serve, go to chatwithleaders.com. Now go enjoy a healthy, encouraging, and joy-filled day.